This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, March 25th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. How do and how should social media companies celebrate the value of free speech, moderate content, and also no big deal, earn a profit? Thomas Kadri is a resident fellow at the Yale Information Society Project. We spoke during the Cato Institute's Who's Afraid of Big Tech event this month.
I gotta say, it seems like an impossible task for social media platforms to sufficiently respect the right of free speech. I mean, it's not really a right of free speech on these online platforms. These are private platforms, but at least celebrate that value truly and deeply, while at the same time creating a positive experience for users from which these companies derive massive revenue. Can you thread that needle?
Well, I try and thread it in my work in some context, but I totally agree that, you know, in some ways it really is this Sisyphean task that they have, where, you know, if they take up, you know, take down too much content, they get slammed on one side, and then if they leave up too much, then they get slammed on the other side. And it is true that just the scale of moderation that they need to do presents unique challenges that we just haven't seen in any other context, really. But that being said, you know, I think it's still important that just because it's a really difficult task doesn't mean that we just abdicate all sorts of scrutiny. And, you know, that's what I try and do. And many other people are in a similar position trying to hold these platforms accountable, even if, you know, as you said, they're private platforms. They have a lot of leeway in the way that they want to moderate content. They don't have to adhere to the First Amendment in the same way that a government has to. But what my scholarship, as it were, sort of focuses on is the ways in which these platforms do actually incorporate legal concepts in their moderation policies. And it's interesting, I think, to look at the ways that it's sort of similar to the legal doctrine that we have and the ways in which it diverges. And I think it can, you know, reveal really interesting lessons, both for how the platforms are maybe doing it better and how sometimes they're doing it worse.
Right, because, you know, these platforms, their job is to sort of be an honest tradesman with across all of their users, and they can't possibly make all of them happy with respect to taking this down and leaving this up and saying this person violated our terms of service and this person did not. Is it important, even in your view, for these firms to try to celebrate free speech?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential, I think, for them to. You know, I mean, we can certainly quibble with what free speech should mean online, whether it should be part and parcel exactly the same as what we think of in the offline context. And I think that there are some good reasons why maybe slightly different norms should govern or different rules should govern. But I think certainly, you know, as a sort of basic matter, yes, free speech is really important online. And that's for the simple reason that so much of our public discourse these days is going on these platforms. And so, you know, what we're seeing now, I think, is these platforms starting to really fully embrace that responsibility that they have to protect free speech, and talking about themselves, you know, recognizing that they do have this governance power, that they have this responsibility, but they also have this responsibility to their users' safety and to certain other public values. Now, whether they're doing a good job on that is kind of another matter, but at the very least, I think the days where these platforms used to just say, "Oh no, you know, we're just a tech company, we're just neutral, we don't have to deal with some of these larger public questions," those seem to be gone now, at least within, you know, the major players in this space. They recognize that they have certain duties and responsibilities, and they're trying to act on them. And so I think it's now important that we look at the ways in which they're doing that and scrutinize that, but we can at least move beyond the question of whether they should be doing something about it.
With apologies to my friends who work for Facebook, it seems like their process is fairly ad hoc, that there is no systemic way to credibly and reliably mete out whether or not someone should be deplatformed or take a break or put in the penalty box or however they decide to do it. Is that really possible for these big tech firms without employing a massive new workforce, or even if they can employ a massive new workforce to do content moderation, is it really possible?
Yeah, so I think hiring more people is going to be a big part of this of trying to solve for some of these problems. I don't buy it when, you know, one of the refrains that we often hear is, oh, well, just the scale of content is so huge and they would need to hire so many people to be able to do this well. And my response for the most part there is, well, yes, then they should hire more people. And there are certain types of review here that just aren't going to lend themselves well to automated detection. And for that, you actually need human review and you need some more nuanced analysis. And if having more people trained in being able to do that is what needs to happen, then I think that that's what needs to happen. But it doesn't need to be the only way that we go about this process. I mean, one thing that I've started, you know, looking into in more depth are some of these oversight regimes that are being proposed now. So Facebook has its Supreme Court that it's thinking about creating or that it's pledged to create within this year. And you know, that is another way to bring some transparency and accountability, if it's done right, that is, to this process, that it relies obviously still on human content moderation and will require them to hire some people. But just by bringing some transparency to the process, we can actually hopefully improve it. One of the reasons I think, you know, you're absolutely right to say that one of the problems that we have is that it at the very least, it seems very ad hoc. Whether it is ad hoc or not is actually difficult for us to say. And that's because we just don't know what's going on behind these closed doors and how these decisions are being made, who's making them. Are they striving for consistency between them? Is there some sort of reasoned way in which they're, you know, saying, well, yeah, this one comes down and this one stays up? Or is it really just as arbitrary as it might seem from the outside? I don't have a firm opinion on that because we just don't have the information to be able to say. But through some of these new governance regimes and these institutions that they are kind of creating, we might hope to at least have a little more of a window into seeing how these decisions are being made, and then we can hold them accountable through that.
Is there or have you seen examples of a technological fix, that is to say, building something into the platform where comments that do not have credibility with a user's group of friends or people they regularly interact with just being seen by fewer people, that is to say, allow content moderation to be done mostly by the user base? I'm thinking right. of how Reddit does moderation of content, and, you know, not everything pops up on my screen when I'm going through things on Reddit.
Right. No, I mean, some of those user-based moderation policies are really interesting to think about. And I think they're going to become perhaps even more important now because a lot of these platforms seem to be moving towards more of these more like private spaces for communication. And in fact, I was just watching last week an interview that Mark Zuckerberg did with Jonathan Zittrain at Harvard Law School. And Zuckerberg was asked the question, you know, what do you see as being the next 5 years for your platform and for this industry? And he was very, very clear and very quick to answer. He said, I think we're going to be reconstituted around these private communicative spaces. And, you know, what he has in mind there is things like WhatsApp and Messenger, which are important parts of his sort of empire of social networking. But it's sort of interesting to think about how that might manifest itself both at Facebook and in other areas. But going back to your question about, you know, some of this self-moderation or moderation by users, or maybe having different moderation within different parts of the platform, I think we might actually finally see that coming to fruition, because it may be that within a sort of a smaller group or within a private communication between two people or only a handful of people, the different sorts of norms and policies really should take place. And so that's an area that I'm going to be watching closely to see whether maybe they're going to give users a little more control and autonomy about the types of rules that they want to set within those communicative spaces that aren't as public as, say, the news feed or as somebody's Twitter profile or somebody's public YouTube page, for example.
I see a lot of opportunity here in these content moderation policies that seem not exactly even-handed. Members of Congress, I suspect, would love and perhaps have grandstanding on the issue of Facebook or Twitter or YouTube deciding that this content is appropriate and that content is not appropriate and trying to turn this into an issue where government will have a significant role. Does that have legs? And why would you not think that that's a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, so what we've seen recently certainly is a lot of soapbox standing from particularly people on the more conservative side of the aisle saying that these social media platforms are discriminating. And from what I've picked up on from the kind of the response to that is that it doesn't bear out in sort of actuality, and people really seem to not be buying that. Now, there are a lot of people who I'm sure are hearing these kind of speeches that are being made about that, and they are accepting it or they're believing it. But I think that, you know, when it comes down to it, whether that sort of rhetoric is going to really take hold, I'm kind of skeptical of that. And so I think it'll be a nice way to maybe rally some of the base on those issues. But I kind of don't think that that's going to have a lasting power. I think that for the most part, these platforms, they certainly make all sorts of mistakes. Nobody, I think, is disputing that. Even the platforms accept that. But the idea that they're acting with some sort of like partisan bias, I just don't think is really going to play out. Now, whether this will lead, interestingly, to more platforms coming about, or, you know, platforms that cater to different tastes, or that, you know, people will perceive to be more neutral, or maybe even more bias, but bias in sort of a direction that people feel it will be, you know, the reverse of the status quo. That's kind of interesting to think about. But I don't see it really changing the dynamics of the industry all that much.
Thomas Kadri is with the Yale Information Society Project. We spoke at the Cato Institute's Who's Afraid of Big Tech event this month. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.